Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. My name is Paul Taylor, and I am the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. Tonight, we will take another step and go deeper into the scientific side of this remarkable public conversation on the leading edge of consciousness and culture. It is essential that we bring higher consciousness not just into our lives, but into our world, and that we come to more clarity about how spirituality can help us make a practical difference. These deep and probing Beyond Awakening dialogue, they're certainly moving us forward in that process in a very remarkable way, a way that needs to be grounded in body, mind, and spirit, and not just in the spirit, but also in the physiology, and not just in the mind, but also in the brain. It's profoundly inspiring for me to be engaged in a leading-edge conversation with almost 30,000 like-minded friends, all participating in this incredible probe into this leading edge of emergent conversation. And if you're hearing this and not already registered, please go to beyondawakeningseries.com, where you can sign up and receive the information you need to download the series introduction and our first few dialogues, and receive links to participate live in the new dialogues as they take place. I also want to point you to our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. It's updated regularly. This is where you'll find the schedule for the next several months, and you'll also find links where you can download the dialogues that have already taken place. You'll also be able to meet and exchange thoughts with some of the other people who are part of our community and see some of the questions that they're interested in. So the conversation that began there will be migrating very soon to a brand new community site. I'll be announcing more about that as soon as it's ready to go live. The second place I want to point you to is our emails. That's where you will find links to participate live. If you don't see your email, please check your spam folder and add us to your address book. Please make sure that you're set up to accept emails from Beyond Awakening Series at evolvingwisdom.com. The other way to engage is by joining our Facebook group, and there you can find links and announcements, meet other members of our worldwide community, and engage in ongoing discussions. Just click on the Facebook link in the email that we sent you today, or go to beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. So, it's time to introduce you to Integral Spiritual Practice founder Terry Patton, who is the founder and visionary behind this groundbreaking series, as well as our host. Terry Patton is a vital leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality. He speaks and consults internationally, inspiring, challenging, and connecting integral evolutionary leaders and institutions worldwide. A gifted communicator, community builder, successful entrepreneur, educator, and author of four books, Terry has worked for over three decades as a philosopher, an activist, a coach, and a teacher, helping leaders embody higher consciousness and practical actions that transform complex systems. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry.
Well, thanks, Paul, and hi, everybody. I want to begin by saying thank you to all the members of the team that works together to produce this event. And special thanks also go to the generous sponsors who are making it possible for us to offer this to everybody absolutely free. But most of all, I want to say thank you to each of you who's listening right now. It's because you're inquiring and thinking and caring sincerely and seriously that this is an authentic and significant and meaningful conversation. And one of my favorite parts of the call will come at the end when we'll open up the phone lines so that at least for a few seconds we can begin to hear at least a few of each other's voices. You know, there are almost 30,000 people who have registered to participate in this series, and it's really kind of exciting to feel even a portion of that number. Not everybody can do this. Those of you who have called in on the web, who are listening via the web, we can't hear you, but tonight is a special night for me. It's really a delight to be welcoming and hosting someone who I think is one of the clearest and most credible voices in the world of contemporary scientific spirituality, neuropsychologist Rick Hansen, in a conversation we're calling The Awakening Brain, and Awakening Your Brain to Free Your Mind also. This series was conceived to convene a conversation about how our spirituality can grow and evolve to enable us to rise to the unique challenges that are arising in our time and to create a cultural context for a transition to a sustainable human presence on planet Earth, and one in which we can thrive in our inner and outer worlds. Many of us originally came into the path, into spiritual life, because we sensed that our world was facing new challenges that required some people, at least, to grow to a higher level of consciousness, and we wanted to contribute. We wanted to be part of that solution. But we are at a moment when many of us feel it's time to ask, exactly how does a higher consciousness delivered by our contemporary practice really pay off that intention? Or does it help some of the most sensitive and intelligent among us to go inward instead of outward, and instead of leaning in to change human culture and society so we can adapt to our pressing crises, does it end up that we're leaving the world in the hands of those who were less deep and less sensitive? And maybe that's part of why things are so challenging right now. So in the introduction to this series, I described how there is a new synthesis to human knowledge, the great evolutionary synthesis, and how seeing that this cosmic process is really from the beginning, for 13.7 billion years, that it's been growing in its complexity, its interconnectedness, its cooperation, and its intentionality or consciousness. Awakening can't only be about getting off the wheel of birth and death. There's something going on in this relative domain that seems to be heading somewhere. And especially taken together with our current world crises, how does this recontextualize our spirituality? So I talked with Ken Wilber about the various higher states and stages of human consciousness and how we might be at the dawning of a new integral age. Michael Murphy talked with me about how an incarnational spirituality based on practice seems to be arising. Andrew Cohen pressed in about the urgency, the ecstatic and free urgency of the evolutionary impulse. Claire Zammit talked about how there's something really powerful going on with women, and a new quality of feminine power and spirituality seems to be emerging. And in our last session, Gangaji and I talked about how awakening to absolute freedom in consciousness might relate to acting on our relative responsibilities as citizens of a world in crisis. Today, I'm really delighted to be talking with Dr. Rick Hansen, who's a neuropsychologist, a longtime Buddhist practitioner who specializes in applying the latest findings of neuroscience to the day-to-day practice of living a life of sanity and contribution. He wrote the book Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, which, in addition to being very well-written, truly original, eminently practical, sane, soothing guide to the many unobvious but common sense often implications of brain research. This book has, since its publication a little less than a year ago, just climbed the charts. It's become a bona fide bestseller and has been the single best-selling book in the spirituality category on Amazon every day for the last 4 months solid. And it's now being translated and published in 10 languages. So Rick has become an extremely busy fellow, and I'm grateful to have him on our series. His work has been featured on the BBC, in Consumer Reports Health, U.S. News and World Reports, and as well as in a lot of the Buddhist publications, Tricycle, Insight, Inquiring Mind, and his posts appear on Huffington Post, including one just freshly that's kind of interesting we may chat about, Psychology Today, other major websites. And he edits the Wise Brain Bulletin, which you can find online, along with a real treasure trove of resources relating to neurodharma and practice at wisebrain.org. Rick's personal website is rickhansen.net. And speaking personally, in the interest of full disclosure, I should let you know that Rick has been a close personal friend of mine for over 25 years. We met on the path, and we've watched each other complete our educations, buy or build and sell homes and businesses, change our careers, have kids, raise them, and we've consulted and supported each other quite a bit over the years. When Rick founded the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom, he asked me to serve on the board, so I've been privileged to be part of his circle of advisors as he's manifested his really remarkable work. Soon you'll get a sense for the clarity and directness and modesty and sweetness and yet substance that characterizes Rick as a person. And you may also get a sense that he's an incredibly competent and disciplined guy. He's the real deal when it comes to actually knowing the research in detail and modestly, not inflating things. When it comes to talking about deep meditative practice, he also knows what he's talking about. And one of the things that I love about Rick is the way he's been growing, just even over the last few years, during which time he's really been walking his talk about this deep investigation of how brain patterns structure our minds and how we can use our minds to change our brains for the better. So welcome, Rick.
Thank you, Terry. And I think I am blushing, you know, under my tan, but I have to say that was very touching for me and moving way beyond, you know, a kind of cliche of thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean, I really mean it. And I also want to say that just reflecting on this series you put together, you know, I've had the privilege of being a participant in a number of teleseminar series at this point that are in which I feel honored to be among the guests. It's a little bit that line where you know, it's the inversion of the Groucho Marx line where you look around the room and you think, what in the world am I doing in this club? Do I really belong here? You know, it's the opposite of I would not want to join a club that would have me. But then I think about yours, and honestly, it's unique. It's truly a cut above even every other thing I've ever done. I mean, the quality of the participants, your own construction of this and clarity about it, the caliber of the people listening and participating, it really is truly in a category of its own. And it's really an honor to be here.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Well, let's launch in. I invited you to participate here, not just because you're my pal, but because I think you bring a unique voice and perspective, accounting for how our neurology tends to structure our inner experience and our outer behavior, and, you know, extrapolating the usable and practical implications from the latest findings in neuroscience. So, you know, to set a context for what we can contribute to moving this larger conversation forward tonight, I'd like to invite you to speak to one of the fundamental paradoxes that underlies your work, because you're a practitioner of one of probably maybe the or close to the most ancient contemplative path, Theravadan Buddhism, and yet you're a student of the very latest fast-breaking research in brain science and interested to apply them to the skillful means of practice. So there's obviously something about your stance that is about something that has never changed in many thousands of years and something else that's changing very fast. So what is the essence of practice, you know, that doesn't change? And what is it that's advancing and evolving so rapidly right now?
I think that's a really interesting question. And I think of the world's extant traditions, you know, the two that are actually even older than Buddhism in terms of their contemplative wing, certainly, and even more broadly is Hinduism, of course, as you probably well know, and the shamanic traditions, the indigenous contemplative and spiritual traditions around the world as well. That said, it is interesting just to reflect on the ways in which the Buddha lived and taught and died about 500 years before Jesus, you know, lived and taught and died, and 1,000 years before Muhammad lived and taught and died. So it does put it in some kind of a context there, doesn't it? In terms of what's evolving, I really look forward to this conversation because I think we'll have some great zigs and zags. But as a first thought, you know, people use words related to spirituality in different ways, and I really like Freeman Dyson's notion. You know, Freeman Dyson, the world-class nuclear physicist, and he wrote a phenomenal book back in the 80s called Weapons and Hope, in which he straddled the world of both hardcore weapons scientists. His cred goes all the way back to the dark days of the Blitz in London when he was helping develop radar systems there in 1943, all the way through, you know, the height and peak of the Cold War, in which he worked for the U.S. Defense Department, and then beyond. And nonetheless, he retained a very humane and large-hearted view. So anyway, Dyson's notion of God, or the divine broadly, is of a learning divine. And I think that's quite interesting. That notion is not original to him, first to mention, but it's a very deep notion. But that said, I tend to think of, in a world of changes, the divine is that which does not change, ultimately, including the nature of things. And I think, in my own view, the divine is woven into the nature of things, which is endlessly emergent, manifest in, for a vanishingly small interval of time, that is now, the eternal now, and then fading away, that is also unconditioned in some fundamental senses at its leading edge. So that's my notion of the divine to some extent. In any case, that I think was the case, when Krishna and Arjuna were talking on the fields, in the Bhagavad Gita, and, I think it was the case when the Buddha was going into and out of Nibbana, and so forth. And I still think it's the case today, and I think it will be the case 10,000 years from now, long after my books and the books of some of the other people, or at least I'll say my own books, have probably turned to dust and been forgotten. So I don't know if that which we awaken to is actually evolving. I'm not sure that which we awaken to is evolving. But I do think that how we apprehend that which we awaken to is definitely evolving. And the paths we take and the needs we meet is also evolving. And also clearly, in a two-way street, the ways in which spiritual practice of any and all kinds needs to engage the real circumstance of our real world, ranging from daily life in commuting and grappling with a million emails and so forth every day, all the way out to, the large stage of issues of, global species extinction and global warming and all the rest of that. So that's my first crack at it. And I do think that appreciating the ways in which I think if you think about the evolving brain, which is something I think about a fair amount, evolutionary neuropsychology, if you will, as a very powerful lens or frame in which, and a humbling one, in which to take a look at these issues. In that larger context, I think that the spirituality appropriately of the earliest makers of stone tools who lived and loved and died 2.5 million years ago, yet did so with brains a third our size. I think that one of the major teachings of evolution is one of brotherhood and sisterhood. It's one of kinship with all creatures, that swim and walk and fly. We're all the above, because we're all brothers, we're cousins. And, I think it's useful to appreciate when we get a little high and mighty that we share about 20% of our DNA with that of a banana, let alone an earthworm or a dust mite or a lizard or a rat or a monkey or a human, or a caveman. Anyway.
Expand the human family beyond the human.
I'm not prepared to say that a dog doesn't have Buddha nature. I'm not prepared to say that there isn't some subtle or its version of spirituality, in a lizard basking on a hot rock doing push-ups, up and down in the warm sun. And so I look back, and not just with the Neanderthals and with early humans who demonstrated through symbolic behavior that has left a record, that they clearly had some spiritual life. But even before that, I would take it all the way back. That said, I think it's very likely, we can't prove it without a time machine, but I think it's very likely that the spirituality of the first toolmakers was not exactly like our own, right? Nor was the spirituality of the very first genetic humans, 150,000 years ago, exactly like our own, because they didn't apparently have the language capacities that we have, which really came in with some mutations in the capacity to produce fine motor control of speech sounds, and therefore needed capacities to comprehend the meanings, that were being now conveyed by those more tightly controlled sounds, 50 or 60,000 years ago. I think spirituality appropriately has evolved just in terms of the evolving brain, let alone, good golly, ways that culture has evolved since to the advent of agriculture and domesticating animals 10,000 years ago, or the advent of the written word, you know, 5,000 years ago. So hopefully that was not an overlong answer to your question.
Well, no, that's right in line with, you know, part of what I've been very inspired by lately is the sense that this evolution of culture is important, and that there is a particular moment that we're in right now, a transition that we are hopefully in the process of making, a very wrenching one that requires us to operate in ways that violate a lot of hardwired impulses toward dominance and aggression and all the rest if we're going to cooperate and forge a sustainable human presence on the planet in relation to our biosphere so we can keep evolving. And it seems that our spirituality is therefore having to help us accomplish something that really has a newness to it. And therefore, I wonder if this is a moment in which something, in a sense, that just contemplating the patterns in an abstract way isn't enough. Somehow we're needed on the field, not in the stands.
Yeah.
And our spirituality has to help us do that. That mere transcendence, contact with the unchanging divine, is, you know, confers a profound sense of peace and meaning and freedom and release. And, you know, one can't overstate how powerful that grace is. But we also have some business here on the ground. And how does our spirituality empower that?
You've noticed. Well, on that, I want to start by, you know, observing the irony, which just occurs to me here, which has just occurred to me a moment ago, which is that it's interesting that many of the spiritual teachers these days, like Ken Wilber, for example, or some of your previous guests, for example, the woman you had who was talking about a feminine spirituality, or others, have really drawn us back into a recognition of the body and also the ways in which culture and, you know, and embodied presence in culture patterns the way we think about things. In other words, if you spend your life as a hunter-gatherer, you know, beneath the stars, that will take you into a different mode of engagement with the world and therefore a different mode of embodied knowing of the world that inevitably will shape your spiritual practices in ways that are different from someone who is living in Babylon 4,000 years ago, after cities emerged, you know, on the backs of agriculture, you know, because there were surpluses then. So, and I think it's interesting that it's very often the spiritual teachers who are making us really appreciate the importance of paying attention to the evolving brain, embedded in an evolving body that co-evolves and co-emerges with evolving culture. Because, of course, the two, you know, arise interdependently. So I think that's pretty sweet. I think that's pretty good. So the second thing I would say is I think that paying attention to the brain, for me at least, and I think other people have really resonated with this point. A little later, maybe we can talk about the resonance I experienced just today, Sunday, October 3rd, when this post I did on Huffington Post came out with regard to Stephen Colbert's, you know, rally to keep fear alive and so on. But anyway, one of the things that you really appreciate when you think about the brain is how hardwired it is for fear and aggression and also a sense of separation, you know, from the world. And it's not that we're doomed. I think that the resting state of the brain, when people are not threatened or hungry or in pain or biochemically disturbed or catastrophically separated from those they love, when we're in that state of mind, the brain does default to a natural condition, a natural state that, for me, I think of it as characterized by three C's in terms of the three motivational systems of the brain, you know, that evolved stacked on top of each other over time, those being the avoiding system, which, you know, we share with lizards and fish, and then came the approaching system, which came in with more sophisticated lizards and early mammals, and then we have the attaching system, which really came in with mammals and birds, and then especially primates, and now especially human beings. Well, in terms of those three systems, when we're not threatened, not in pain, and so forth, we tend to default to a state of calm in terms of the activation of the avoiding fight-or-flight system, a state of contentment with regard to the approaching goals, pursuing carrot system, and a state of caring with regard to the attaching system. The problem is, to keep our ancestors alive in times when getting carrots was important, but avoiding sticks was more consequential on any given day, usually for survival, then we have a brain that is on a hair trigger, now armed with nuclear weapons, alas, on a hair trigger to shift into a different mode, away from a kind of responsive groundedness of, you know, calm, caring, and contentment, calm, contentment, and caring, into a much more reactive mode that, for me, is, you know, in line with the deep teachings of Buddhism, much more organized around greed, hatred, and heartache. And so that's the challenge a lot, is to help ourselves take the fruit as the path, in effect, in the saying from Tibetan Buddhism, and help ourselves increasingly ground in our home base. That's why, you know, I'm very hopeful fundamentally. You know, the home base is good news. Ground in our home base of, you know, calm, contentment, and caring. And by grounding in that home base increasingly, since neurons that fire together wire together, you know, and the famous saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. The more you stimulate the neural substrate of a wholesome state of mind, the more you strengthen that neural substrate and thereby draw the mind increasingly into that mode of being, if you will. So to finish up, the more we can take, the fruit is the path, you know, sinking into our true nature at all levels, including our, you know, neural biological true nature, the more likely we are going to be able to be to, you know, rest increasingly in that mode. And that's why I do get hopeful that, you know, programs like this are an illustration of a larger point that with, you know, more and more access to good information, you know, and including in my little corner of the world, you know, more and more capacity to take charge of the caveman brain, cavewoman, caveman brain, now armed with nuclear weapons in the 21st century, you know, we can do our bit to make this world a better place.
That's beautiful, Rick. You know, thinking about what you just said, that neurons that fire together wire together, and thinking about something I've read in your writings, even in that Huffington Post blog post that you just mentioned, if our brain is Velcro for negative experience and Teflon for positive experience, and neurons that fire together wire together, then our brains become a map of our experience that distorts it, that is essentially exaggerating the negative and underrepresenting the positive, such that all of us are walking around with a set of memories and instinctual responses that map our experience in a way that lies to us and that keeps us magnifying our pain and difficulty and minimizing our positive experience, and that would be the fundamental distortion that everybody's kind of carrying around. It's like we all have to account for this optical illusion that's in our neurology.
Yes. Well, I think you said it well. I mean, the good news is that positive events are much more common in most people's lives. Many studies have shown positive events are much more common. It's just that negative events have more impact. So there are multiple layers of systems in the brain that continually scan for bad news, and then as soon as they find it, they zero in on it, you know, filter out everything else, rapidly store it. We have dedicated systems that instantly store negative information and then retrieve it at anything that's the least bit associated with that old pain, if you will. And that's why, as I say, and you quoted me, the brain is indeed like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. And you're exactly right that those tendencies do lead us to incline, we're very vulnerable toward, is the way I would put it, we're very vulnerable toward inclining in a negative direction. In other words, inclining toward fear, inclining toward, you know, anger of various kinds, toward sorrow and loss and hurt. We're vulnerable there. You know, the good news is that there are counter forces, and that's good. You know, yes, indeed. But I think that those counter forces, and to which I put you, honestly, Tara, I have tremendous respect for you. I get to say publicly now, I love you as a brother, but beyond that, I just always had incredible respect for you, and you deserve it. And I'm very happy that you know, you're getting a wider recognition of respect these days, and I think it will undoubtedly get ever, you know, wider. You know, I think there are good forces in the world today, and I think that part of the age-old path of the ruling elites has tended to be to make people afraid. You know, whether it's you know, Hitler in Germany or Joseph McCarthy here at home, or you know, Mao Zedong or Stalin, you know, left wing or right wing, any ruling elite tends to want to make its people afraid, because then they will more readily be cowed. They'll pull their horns in, and they won't look too closely at what the ruling elites are doing, and they'll put up with more to get, in a sense, strong father protection, you know. So I think appreciating our vulnerability as a species for fear, what I call paper tiger paranoia, where we classically, you know, underestimate threats. I mean, we overestimate threats, rather, underestimate opportunities and resources. You know, to appreciate our vulnerability for that, both politically and in our personal life, to appreciate the degree to which it's easy for people to learn to be helpless and very hard to undo that learning. You know, it's easy as soon as we start feeling there's a separation between us and them to fear and dehumanize them and very quickly and often aggress against them, quote-unquote them. You know, to the degree that we appreciate those challenges, then I think we can be more direct about dealing with them. And one thing that's been important for me as a guy who's been in the human potential movement and to some extent the New Age world and definitely the Buddhist world in the West over the last 35 years, I think there's been a tendency to sentimentalize human nature sometimes, you know, not always, but sometimes, and to not really appreciate the degree to which, for example, that, you know, every heart has a wolf of love in it, in the Native American saying, but also in the Native American teaching, it has a wolf of hate. And we have to really watch that wolf of hate, and we have to watch the wolf of, or the little bunny of fear, you know, in our inner menagerie. We have to be careful about these critters and take, you know, and take charge of them. Otherwise, they'll take charge of us.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, along those lines, one of the, for me, the most powerful takeaways from your application of these breakthroughs has been the practice of taking in the good as a practice, as a way of balancing out the tendency or my vulnerability to neurologically distort. And I've been, as a practice, when anything good happens, you know, just now when you praised me, you know, I breathe. And I take it in. And knowing that it takes 11 seconds for me to take in a good experience as powerfully as I take in negative experiences in mere milliseconds has been just a very revealing and important insight. And I want to offer you a chance to expand on that.
Oh, thank you. And I would say, just because, for better or for worse, and my wife once said, honey, you've got OCD. I said, no, sweetie, I'm just impeccable. So for the truth is, I'm sure I have some version of OCD. So there, I just want to say that, you know, I think sometimes it takes 11 seconds for a positive experience to go in. Sometimes it takes 20 or 30, you know, for it to be transferred from short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. And then sometimes, you know, a million-dollar moment, a very intense positive experience, you know, like, let's say, being in the, you know, being there when your child is born, say, whether you're the mother or the father, you know, that's going to be very memorable. That's going to be instantly stored. But you're right. In general, you know, positive experiences just get standard memory systems. And that means that if you don't really stay with it, it just kind of passes through. But negative experiences, you know, being upset, being irritated, being anxious, being just feeling down, feeling blue, all that activates the sympathetic nervous system and the ancient fight or flight stress response machinery in the nervous system and the endocrine system and the cardiovascular system and the digestive system and the immune system. It's a mess, right? So anyway, soon as we get upset, whamola, that stuff gets sucked in into implicit memory, which is distinct from explicit memory, which is where recollections and explicit knowledge about the world. Most of the action is in implicit memory, which is below the waterline. We tend to be not very conscious of it, but it continually shapes the inner atmosphere of the mind and shapes our expectations, our response biases, or in our assumptions, you know, our views, if you will, about the world, as well as mood and so forth. Anyway, so that's why I have really emphasized the practice of taking in the good. I did not invent taking in the good. I think it's woven in tacitly into many good therapies or personal growth practices and spiritual trainings. But what I have tried to do is to really clearly explicate why it's so important to continually focus on legitimate good facts and then allow those to become good experiences and then savor them for 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row to get those neurons firing together so they wire together. And then third step, sense and intent that this positive experience is sinking into you, you know, so that it's gradually being woven into the fabric of your brain and yourself, a resource that you can take with you wherever you go. So to recap three steps, you know, step one, look for good facts and let them become good experiences, whether it's just getting a load of laundry done or, you know, surviving a crummy business meeting or, you know, a crummy relationship or, you know, somebody's paid you a compliment, you know, it's happened between you and me a few minutes ago, or you just step outside and, you know, the flowers are blooming and you're not dead yet and no bombs are going off in, you know, your pizza parlor and it's okay, right? Take that in. Savor it. That's the second step. Savor it. And then third step, sense and intend that it goes into your being. So I find those are very powerful to do. And then there's, of course, an optional fourth step you don't have to use. But if you want, if you are having a positive experience, you can direct it toward old places of pain inside. For example, places of feeling wronged or places of feeling abandoned or unloved or not seen or not respected or frustrated and disappointed and so forth. And gradually let the current positive experience associate neurologically with that old place of pain or lack or wound. And gradually, over time, soothe it, you know, infuse it with positive emotion, and potentially, ultimately, even replace it in terms of its emotional charge in your mind. And you're right. I love this practice myself, taking in the good. I mean, what a sweet thing to do for anyone, as well as for kids. You know, I work with kids a lot, and I think all kids really benefit from this practice, particularly kids and I think adults as well who are on either end of the temperamental spectrum, either the kind of anxious end or the spirited end. And anyone who's had significant, painful, or difficult life experiences would really benefit from taking in the good. A little caution, if you've had very painful or traumatic life experiences, be careful about using the fourth step. It's, you know, for the fourth step to work, you're holding two things in awareness at once, you know, the new positive experience and the old pain. And you've got to make the new positive experience more prominent. If you start getting hijacked or sucked into the black hole of the old pain, drop it. You know, don't go there because, you know, if you're in that old pain and past the point of it being productive for you, you're just doing another lap in hell. And every time you lap around the track, because neurons that fire together wire together, you know, you're digging the groove a little deeper. So, okay.
Yeah, right. Well, that's really great. Now, I'd like to ask you to kind of expand from there, maybe into some other related things. One of the themes that we've really looked at is how all of us are stressed by the interruption-driven, fast-paced and accelerating volume of information that characterize our lifestyles. And anybody who's been a practitioner whether you've been a practitioner or not, anybody just remembers back, anyone old enough to remember back, 10 or 15, even 20 years, you know, wow, it's changed, and it's definitely intensified. And that's a change in the territory of life that is culturally shifted, you know, so recently that skillful means for addressing how that can dysregulate or confuse us are really valuable. So what do you have to say there?
Well, I agree with you. You know, on the one hand, there is a tendency sometimes to make one's own time special. You know, I think about the ways that all times are historically unprecedented, you know, by definition. Although, I think sometimes,
right.
It's like the animals in Animal Farm, Orwell's Animal Farm, you know, some animals are more equal than others. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And I think all times are historically unprecedented, but some are more unprecedented than others. And this is one of them. There's no question about that. In terms of the intensity and the confluence of so many changes and the rate, the pace at which change is occurring, and the accelerating, you know, second order derivative, if you will, of the rate of change is also accelerating. And so in that context, we are experiencing, and I know that you're working on a book on this, and I'm looking forward to you, you know, getting it out there, the rate, the amount of incoming stimuli in terms of its pace and its intensity, its demand characteristics, and its variety is absolutely unprecedented neurologically. In other words, the brain, the rate of change of the brain is really quite slow. And it's driven, in terms of its neurology, by biological evolution, not cultural evolution. Cultural evolution is very, very fast. Biological evolution is a lot slower. Quick sidebar, yes, there is some evidence that in terms of epigenetics, which has to do with the expression of genes, that while the genes themselves don't necessarily evolve over a matter of just a few generations, it appears that it's possible in certain regards to pass along epigenetic changes, in other words, changes in the expression of genes based on life experiences and mental activity within a few generations. But apart from that, very, very interesting, and I'm talking about research that's typically less than 5 years old. It's very, very cutting edge, this sort of epigenetic stuff that passes from generation to generation. Other than that, you know, the brain takes a long time to evolve, and it did not evolve to handle normal life with emails, phone calls, and all the rest. So the result of that is to activate the stress response system because it's a threat. It disturbs the equilibrium of the nervous system. So the nervous system, and therefore then in a cascade, the endocrine system, the hormonal system, as well as other bodily systems like cardiovascular, immune, and digestive, and so forth, they mobilize to deal with this disturbance, this incoming intensity. It's sort of like if you, you know, are in a room and suddenly there's a loud sound, right? Even if it's not an inherently threatening sound, like the, you know, roar of a lion right behind your ear, just a loud sound or a loud flash or a suddenly intense smell, just the suddenness, the intensity of the stimulus will activate an alarm reaction in your body because, you know, you and I have been talking a bit here, you know, we evolved to be easily alarmed. Our ancient ancestors that were all zen, you know, were all super mellow and looking at the light on the leaves and chilling, right? Whap! They got eaten. They didn't notice the slither nearby or the shadow overhead. You know, the ones that evolved were nervous and cranky. And we are their great-grandchildren, you know, sitting on top of the food chain. So, you know, we have that reaction, including just managing all the, you know, messages we get in a day or all the people talking to us or the pace of media. You know, when you think about flipping through the Internet, yes, some studies have shown that people who look through a lot of, you know, Internet sites do get some activation of their brain, you know, in some new areas. That's good news. But it's offset by a broader pattern of activation in the body-mind as a whole, you know, just in response to the pace of inputs, even positive inputs. And anyone who's unplugged from everyday life and, you know, spent a day in the woods or in a calm setting, or better yet, 10 days in a row in that calm or quieter setting, knows immediately what I'm talking about. So the practical point for me, and that's what I am mostly about in my book and my work, as you said, you know, in your intro. The practical point for me is not to go live in a cave somewhere or a commune in Oregon. I thought about that in the early 70s, but, you know, that didn't go so well. So here we are in modern life and all the rest of that. The way to do it is to get really good at parasympathetic activation, really good as best you can. It's not perfect, but as best you can, get increasingly good at mounting a cooling, calming, connecting response to feeling stressed and activated. And, you know, there are a variety of ways to do it. I'll mention a few right now. They're among my favorites. One is several long exhalations in a row really trigger the parasympathetic nervous system because it handles exhalation. It's the so-called rest and digest system as opposed to the sympathetic nervous system, which is the fight or flight, quote-unquote, system. So if you're getting resting and digesting, you know, exhaling is very involved in resting. And in terms of digesting, relax the tongue because parasympathetic nerve fibers innervate, which means they fill the tissues of the mouth because that's where digestion begins. And people have other methods as well. I'm talking here about using methods kind of online when the body gets activated. It's, of course, great to practice in general what Benson has, Herbert Benson has talked about in terms of the relaxation response. And, of course, teachers were teaching in, you know, India with yoga, you know, thousands of years ago. But I've really come to appreciate that stress, there's a place for healthy stress, you know. There's a place for healthy activation of the sympathetic nervous system, either to deal with a serious crisis or for wholesome excitement, you know, like if your kid finally takes a shot at some, you know, fourth grade basketball game, and maybe because her dad, bribed her with a dollar for every shot she took. I don't care if it hits the basket or not. Just take the shot, kid. But anyway, there's a place for that. But the chronic stress we experience today, the chronic activation of sympathetic nervous system and related, you know, adrenal stress hormone system was not something we evolved for because most of our ancestors were dead before their 40th birthday, often before their 30th birthday. Mother Nature didn't care about the long-term consequences of the short-term benefits of activating the stress response system. It's those of us today who are in middle age or late middle age or early old age or whatever, you know, who are living well. My dad's 91 and a half, and he's got a new lady friend. You know, 91 is the new 71, right, or even 61. And so if we want to live long and prosper, it really behooves us to pay attention to the slowly accumulating and grinding wear and tear of mild to moderate stress, you know, on the body-mind. Mm. Plus, I will say this as well. Sympathetic activation primes aversion. I mean, that's a mouthful. It's not going to be on any billboards or T-shirts soon, probably. But if you activate the sympathetic nervous system, even in positive ways, just getting intense to deal with daily life, because that sympathetic stress response system is mostly tilted, about two-thirds tilted roughly for the negative. That's about the balance in terms of the stress response system. It's about two-thirds ballpark tilted to go negative. For example, about two-thirds of the cells, the neurons in the amygdala, there are two of them in the brain, one on each side of the brain. About two-thirds of the cells in the amygdala, which is the alarm bell of the brain, just track negative information. So that's a way to appreciate the degree to which the stress response system is tilted toward the negative. My point is that even if that system is activated seemingly with some association to positive emotion, it sets us up to be afraid. It sets us up to feel threatened and then overreact if we think there's some kind of a threat. You can experience that if you really think back on a time when you were really excited about something and enthused, maybe a sporting event, and then suddenly somebody said something to you, like your mate or what have you, that's irritating. You know, it's very quick for that wholesome activation to become, you know, angry and fearful. Anyway, that's a long way of saying that. I think it's important to appreciate these systems inside ourselves and to take charge of them, because otherwise the default is that they're going to take charge of you.
So the short summary is chill.
That's it. You said it. What do we need? You know, why don't we just hang out? Who needs the rest of this? Chill, yeah, but chill skillfully, because it's not that easy to chill. I mean, it's easy to chill on the beach. It's easy to chill in a meditation retreat. I mean, I've never been as chill as I get, you know, by the 10th day, let's say, or more, of a long meditation retreat. It's wonderful. And that's one reason why I think taking time, whether it's, you know, an evening a week or a day a week or a day a year, or an evening a year, or better yet, you know, a week a year, to just unplug and you know, settle really down into that home base of the body mind, of the brain that I was referring to, as has routinely been done in all the contemplative traditions. You know, there's a reason why those folks went out into the desert or the forest, you know, or to a cave or to the mountains. They got away, or they tried to create places of sanctuary in the midst of, you know, human communities that were designated places of sanctuary. It's because we need those refuges, you know. I think they're critically important.
Especially, though, in our time.
Exactly.
With the wound-up pace, is
to find a refuge, is to make a refuge inside your own mind, which means making it inside your own brain, right in the middle of the hurly-burly. That's the trick. That's the challenge. And that's where I think we have to rise. We got to deal. We got to be strong. We got
to And part of that is simply having the presence of mind to exercise that judgment, to recognize that in some way we're in some high winds and high waves, and that it's okay that it requires mindfulness and intention to return and to cool our nervous systems, and the fact that we're going to tend to overheat is just kind of coming with the territory, and the fact that we're agitated doesn't mean something negative about us. It's just the kind of territory we're practicing in these days, and that a kind of self-compassionate, skillful helping of our best capacities to come forward is really the point. It's about insight and skill and arming our better intentions and educating them that you may be really focusing on here.
That's exactly right. And just as you said, I think there's an enormous place as well for self-compassion. That's another thing that's a great takeaway from appreciating the embodied nature of mind and spirituality, you know, embodied and natured and cultured, you know, nature of mind and spirituality. You know, AA has a saying, you know, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood, don't go in alone. Or, you know, I think of it as it's a jungle in there, you know, pointing at my own head. Or the idea of, you know, you sleep with the enemy every night between years, or, you know, take up arms against your oppressors, most of which live inside your own head. And the point is that without being self-divided, you know, and without being against or afraid of all of the rooms inside the mansion of the mind altogether. That said, there is a place for, as you're getting at it, self-compassion. And that's another one of my favorite things, you know, from science these days, is where, in which self-compassion is a very hot topic. Really getting how important it is to have compassion for ourselves, not just for those other beings, but for the being that has our name tag.
Yeah. One of the things that I want to get to before we get into our question and answer session is a little bit of a, there's a phrase you've used in other contexts that we tend toward a paranoid trance. And in some of the earlier discussions, I brought up the idea of the consensus trance, that the consensus reality and frame of mind that we get tuned into anytime we turn on the television or interact with the common mind of our culture is to some degree a trance, a particular mindset that is not just accurate or objective, but also a distortion. And one of the things that you've pointed out is that it tends toward paranoia, tends toward a paranoid bias. And much of what you've offered, not just in this call, but in your book and other writings, has to do with achieving a kind of clarity and serenity and acceptance and kind of, you know, the chill, more mellow kind of relationship to things that, you know, does confer a kind of sanity and health. And yet I think it might be valuable to presence that there's an enduring polarity between that serenity and being effective and disciplined. And you know, for me, you know, I feel a higher calling, a sense that this rapid moment of evolution in which we're turning this corner needs conscious participants doing their their best to make a positive contribution, that I'm needed. And that activates me. It helps me feel a kind of urgency that I distinguish between, you know, I distinguish that from the urgency I felt earlier in my life before I'd done much practice, which was kind of a pre-serenity urgency. And there's kind of a post-serenity urgency, you know, that arises from a different place that's entirely positive and not reactive. And you're one of the most disciplined and accomplished and effective guys I know. So you clearly are operating not just as if chilling was the whole main point. You know, you do care to put points on the board and make things happen. So I wonder what you could say about balancing those two important principles as a practical matter in your life and you know, offering tips to others regarding that and that sense of a larger commitment, you know, that our action is not just a virtue in a generalized way, but in some sense, life needs us to participate. And that which gets us up in the morning is not, you know, is a service to something maybe larger than ourselves.
Yes. Well, first, thank you for the acknowledgement. And I'll try to live up to it while simultaneously not working too hard tonight. Let's see. Well, first of all, the whole idea of the paranoid trance, or, because I kind of like the alliteration, paper tiger paranoia. It comes from the idea that if you think about it in nature, in terms of evolution, which was highly lethal. I mean, it's just quite powerful to appreciate the lethality of the natural world. You know, including the world that our evolving great grandparents lived in. For example, just as a sidebar. In the 20th century, which many people consider to be, of course, a terribly bloody century, two world wars and a lot of other ones, nuclear bombs and so forth, about 1 in 100 males died due to warfare, one way or another. That's the estimate, kind of a consensus estimate, about 1%. Well, a number of studies, many studies, which take a look at hunter-gatherer groups in the world today, or the archaeological record of recent ones or going further back in the past, or doing modeling of the evolving conditions in which hunter-gatherer bands competed against each other for very scarce resources in the world over the last, let's call it just 3 million years, you know, since roughly the time of the toolmakers and the tripling of the volume of the human brain. Well, during that period, roughly 12 to 15% of all males died due to violence, mostly between bands. In other words, a 12 to 15-fold increase in the death rate among males of the 20th century. Just to put it in perspective. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we evolved, wolf of love, wolf of hate, you know. We evolved to be incredibly sweet and altruistically cooperative with quote-unquote us, and very fearful and very aggressive toward quote-unquote them. So it's in that backdrop that Mother Nature basically says, look, you've got two mistakes you can make. On the one hand, you can think there is a tiger in the bushes, but there really is no tiger there. All right? Or, second mistake, you can think the coast is clear and all is chill, but there really is a tiger there about to pounce. Now, Mother Nature wants us to make the first mistake 1,000 times over, to avoid making the second mistake even once. Because obviously, if you make the first mistake, you're just anxious, you know, and you may get an ulcer. But if you make the second mistake, whap, no more gene copies forever. All right? So the result of which is that, and again, there are many studies that talk about the nuances and details of this. Negativity bias is what it's called in the brain. There are many studies that talk about it in various kinds of ways, but a key takeaway point is that most people are biased by evolution, and then, of course, comes temperament, life experiences, modern culture, and political manipulations of various kinds. Most people are, the default bias from evolution of the brain is to, as I said earlier, overestimate threats, to see tigers everywhere, or to exaggerate the size or intensity or nearness or proximity of tigers. And second, to underestimate opportunities. not just out there in the world, thinking about big picture things like global warming and Al-Qaeda and whatnot, but with the people sitting across from you at the dinner table or sleeping across from you in bed or working next to you at, in some cubicle. We tend to underestimate opportunities there. And third, we're biased toward underestimating resources, both inside ourselves and in our world, resources for both fulfilling opportunities and dealing with threats. And I call that paper tiger paranoia. It becomes a new normal. You don't even realize it. You just presume it. And then as a result, in ways that are at this point well understood in cognitive psychology, people go around with, because of this bias, if you will, this kind of, in a normative sense, it's the norm to have a kind of paranoid trance, to go around and look for information that confirms the trance and ignore information that doesn't fit it, you know. And so then as a result, I think the results are really obvious politically. Over the last 10 years, we've had a great teach-in, as it were, worldwide in the power of fear and how good people are at activating fear, whether it's Osama bin Laden or Dick Cheney, and playing on fear to serve their own agendas of one kind or another. But to bring it down to home, into a realm that where most people will have more influence, which is to say, in the circle of their daily life and their home and their workplace and their friends and so forth, you know, that we do tend to be very quickly alarmed by other people and very quickly move toward a response that's based on fear, based on stress response activation, based on feeling threatened. We also tend to, you know, once burned, twice shy, we tend to overlearn from negative experiences and ever after pull in our horns, play small, you know, avoid sticking our neck up above the weeds for fear that it'll get chopped off. And it's really quite poignant for me. And I guess to wrap up my response here, I think about the teachings of the Buddha, and not just the Buddha, that fundamentally the source of suffering and harm is ignorance, broadly defined and profoundly defined. And it is, I don't know if this was Jesus or somebody in the Bible said, the truth shall set you free. It's the truth that sets us free. It's clarity. We've got to see real tigers. Obviously, there are forces that try to obscure the real tigers, much as the tobacco companies, you know, fought a very successful rear guard action for 30 years to just create doubt and confusion with regard to the health hazards of smoking. In the same way, you know, people are being paid right now to write memos and press releases and pseudo-studies that will somehow cast doubt and confusion on the obvious evidence that global warming is real and inevitable as long as you keep dumping carbon into the atmosphere, which is basic physics. But on the other hand, for all the real tigers that we're not seeing, I think there are also many, many faux tigers, you know, exaggerated tigers or even completely bogus tigers that actually distract us from dealing with the real tigers of the world.
Right on. Well, I want to lean right in, and yet it's gotten to the place where if I'm going to make some room for some other folks to ask you questions, I'd better do so. So if anyone listening on the via computer would like to go ahead and type out a concise question. If they get a little long, it's harder for us to review them, but if you could type that into the instant teleseminar window starting now, we'll take a look at some of those. And before we begin to answer any questions, I have a few things I'd like to let everybody know about. First, I'd like to thank the presenting organizations of this series, Integral Spiritual Practice and Evolving Wisdom. Beyond Awakening is also made possible and is presented free of charge by the generosity of our many wonderful sponsors, including BeliefNet. Did you know that BeliefNet.com exists to help people like you walk a spiritual path that brings comfort, hope, clarity, strength, and happiness? As the largest spiritual website, not only does BeliefNet offer inspiring devotional tools, access to the best spiritual teachers and clergy in the world, and thought-provoking commentaries, you will also experience the most supportive online community around. Looking for daily support? Sign up now for any BeliefNet newsletter and receive a daily dose of wisdom, humor, inspiration, and more. Visit BeliefNet.com today.
and our Sisters in Evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power. Find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas, and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at femininepower.com. It's titled The Keys to Feminine Power, Awakening the Three Power Bases of the New Co-Creative Feminine. That's online at femininepower.com. And the new movie called Letting Go that will entertain and delight you and exponentially guide you into uncovering and living the truth of who you are. It's designed to support the worldwide awakening to truth that is already sweeping the planet. If you are already exploring the non-dual path, then you will find its insights and perspectives enlightening and refreshing. It also gives you powerful tools to use to introduce non-duality to those around you. Letting Go will give you practical tools that you can use every day to let go of the anxiety, fear, frustration, and limiting emotions that prevent you from recognizing your true nature that cause you to re-identify with the dream. As you watch this movie, it will make you laugh and cry as it deepens your own understanding and openness to your own intuitive knowledge. To order the film, visit lettinggo.tv, lettinggo.tv/movieDVD. And finally, this Tuesday, in just 2 days, again at this same time, 5 p.m. Pacific, be sure to tune in for the next dialogue in this series. I'll be talking with Catherine Woodward Thomas, author and co-founder of the Feminine Power Global Community. We'll be talking about evolving together, why we need each other to become ourselves fully. We'll explore how we might begin to evolve together by learning the skills and capacities that will enable us to form generative evolutionary relationships with one another as a spiritual practice. Okay. Now let's get into the question and answer portion of the evening. Let's see. I have a question here. This is from Fred in Milwaukee. He asks, so how does this knowledge of the brain help us rise to the challenge of this seemingly perilous time in human history?
I think it's right at, I think it's a great question. I mean, it's right at the heart of this. Well, one is to appreciate the bad news, which is that the enemy is not just out there. The enemy is an expression of the inner iguana and inner monkey and inner caveman, cavewoman in here, right? In other words, our hardwired, evolutionarily derived, very effective strategies for passing on gene copies are about to destroy a lot of gene copies over the next 100 years. Whether it's a billion or so people, the poorest of the world, who live on the coasts of the world, who are going to be very affected by global warming and sea level rising, as well as all kinds of other things. So I think one takeaway from brain science is to really appreciate the degree of the challenge. And by understanding it and how it's wired in the brain, that very quickly takes us to solutions. I mean, for example, just in other words, the brain has solutions to the brain's problems. In that it has capacities, for example, to appreciate holes, even as it has tendencies toward division and separation. It has capacities to calm and center, much as it is also on a hair trigger to get excited and dispersed, if you will. In that way, by learning more and more about the brain, and quick sidebar, we're just at the beginning of that process. You know, it's estimated that the amount of knowledge about the 3 pounds or so of tofu-like tissue right between the ears has roughly doubled since 1990, just in the last 20 years. And so, and it's going to keep doubling in the decades to come. So based on all that, I think the opportunity is to understand more exactly how to manage the inner iguana, inner monkey, inner caveman, cavewoman, for greater, happiness and world peace and everything else, personal happiness and world peace and everything else in between. That's the first thing. The second, I think, is to really appreciate the potential of the brain for the upper reaches of human potential. And that's where many emerging studies, or many studies going back to the great work that was often done on TM, with EEG studies going, you know, 20, 30 years ago, or currently is being done with new neuroimaging technologies like fMRIs and so forth, that those studies are showing the ways in which sustained spiritual practice across multiple traditions actually leads to lasting changes in the brain, which in turn correlate with lasting changes in the mind. In other words, as the brain changes, the mind changes. But it's also true that as the mind changes, you can change the brain. That means you can use your mind to change your brain, to change your mind for the better, which is the essence of what I focus on as a methods guide, you know, as a clinician and a teacher. So the point here is that I think for householders, in other words, I think one thing that's happening in our historically unprecedented time is that we are having people who are not living a renunciate life. In other words, they're not monastics, they're not sadhus, they're not hermits. They are householders with you know, jobs, cars, internet access, you know, cable TV, mortgages, kids, relationships, and all the rest of that, but who are also very interested in profound spiritual practice and profound awakening. And so for me, I think it's very useful to understand how the brain works to for those householders who don't have the long, slow grind that's available in the 24/7, you know, rock tumbler of renunciate life or monastic life, who need something, frankly, that's more efficient and also more adapted to the modern temperament that is kind of an ADD, jackrabbity kind of temperament. You know, I think often that contemplative trainings and practices were developed by people with a turtle temperament. You know, four turtles in turtle cages to make them better turtles. But what do we do with the jackrabbits among us, and including those who have been jackrabbitized, you know, by modern culture? So by paying attention, for example, to how the brain pays attention and thereby training it for a greater capacity of mindfulness in the scatterbrained days, that way you can really turbocharge your ability to do serious spiritual practice as a householder, in just one example. Or in another example, if you routinely practice tuning into your own body, you will actually thicken the neural substrate of a part of the brain called the insula, which is involved in both interoception, tracking the body, but also in emotional empathy for other people. So if we want to help people, for example, become more capable of having empathy for somebody with a different colored skin and a different religion living 10,000 miles away, a great way to do that is to start by here, by tuning more into our own bodies over time, because that literally helps build out the neural substrate of emotion, of empathy for the feelings of others. Another thing, by the way, is to appreciate through I think a certain amount of neuroscience is not very useful for spiritual practice, but a lot of it is. And one part, really fast here, is how neuroscience shows that there's no self in the brain. In other words, there's no place that's specific to self. Self is not specific anywhere. Selfing, the sense of self, is emergent and distributed widely throughout the brain. And it arises and passes away, intensifies and de-intensifies, based on conditions. So even in the brain, you can see that there isn't that that one posited in Western psychology and Western philosophy as, you know, the independent, unified, enduring owner of experiences and agent of actions. But in fact, in the brain, it's a much more distributed and emergent and interdependently arising process, which can help us not take things so personally and feel more connected with all beings and all life and the whole world.
That's beautiful. So there are quite a few questions coming in here. Maybe we can try to, you know, have brief answers to several so we can hear
I'll
from several people. Yeah. Margaret in Williamsport, Pennsylvania asks if there are any gender differences in the research on hardwired fear.
Wow, that's a really great question. It's hard to be succinct, but I'll really try to be. So first of all, context here. Any kind of research on the brains of adult males and females is suspect in terms of establishing innate constitutional gender differences present at conception, right? Because little baby boys and baby girls get socialized differently, on the average, certainly, from the moment they're born. And so differences in brains of 30- and 40-year-olds, males and females, are not necessarily the result of a hardwired genetic basis, point one. Point two, whatever those differences are that can be found between the average male and the average female brain of, let's say, a 30-year-old person, the difference between the average male and average female brain is much less than the difference among all female brains and among all male brains. In other words, the between group difference on the average between males and females' brains is much smaller than the within group differences. So I think those are very important points. That said, yeah, it's very interesting. Research by Shelley Taylor, which your caller may be aware of, and others at UCLA, Shelley Taylor is at UCLA, and others have talked about the ways in which, in contrast to men, who do tend to move more toward fight or flight, especially fight, when they're challenged or stressed, women tend to move more toward a tend and befriend response, more mediated by oxytocin, which males and females both have. It's a neurotransmitter and hormone very involved in bonding and sex and attachment. Women have about 7 times as much oxytocin as males do. So it does seem that the female response to fear may well be, in some cases, particularly when there's a deep sense of connection with other supporters, you know, that woman may have a better capacity to be buffered in her experience of threat, you know, than a male might. But it's very complex because obviously, you know, most males walking down a city street at 11 o'clock at night are not necessarily that worried about personal safety. But, you know, I doubt that that's, you know, on the average the case for females in a similar circumstance. So, you know, then you have to toss in life experiences, of course, to get involved in shaping the brain. I think a takeaway point here is to have compassion for everybody, including ourselves, and then whatever our own psychology happens to be, you know, at age 20, 30, or 12, or 92, to do what we can with the breaths that are left to us and the minutes and days and years that are left to us to change our own brain for the better.
Great. Well, I want to invite people who want to raise their hands via the phones to press star 2. We've had some requests about questions. More people will be able to have a chance to be answered if you answer your question concisely and try to keep it direct and to the point. And even though it would be nice to get into an extended conversation, you know, please try to answer the question just once and then take your answer after you've asked it.
Ask the question just once. That's
exactly.
Right.
Ask it once, and we may even have, you know, begin turning off the mic so that we can keep it moving. One question while people are raising their hands from Bob Cornell in Rockport, Massachusetts. He asks, ooh, tigers, doesn't the effective meditation being awake and alert tend to improve our ability to react to real threats as well as to minimize fear?
Thank you, Bob. I don't know you, I think, but that's a great point. Yeah, exactly. In other words, it's about seeing clearly both real tigers and recognizing the difference between real tigers and paper ones. And it is the case, for example, a very interesting study showed that Zen practitioners, this is a study done on them, who were presented with a click, a repetitive click. There's a natural response in the brain. To a new stimulus. It's called the P300 response in terms of EEG studies. Anyway, what usually happens is if we're presented with a repetitive sound, you know, like a click or dripping water, we tune it out after a while. But Zen practitioners in meditation, every time the click arrived, they reacted to it as if it were a new sound. In other words, they did not tune it out. They were able to see the world clearly, even more clearly. So I know that's true for me. I feel much more able to see the world clearly, particularly as I've gotten calmer. You know, and I think about great teachers, you know, or great social activists, really, you know, like Nelson Mandela or the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi immediately come to mind. They had a calm about them. I think about Julia Butterfly Hill. I just watched a video clip of her recently, who's awesome. Very calm, even though she has, as she puts it, fierce compassion. So I think practice can aid our activism. It's not either or.
Very, very good. We have a question from Judith Seltzer in Delray Beach, Florida. Please go ahead.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hi. Yeah, this is actually Mike Seltzer, maybe on Judy's cell phone.
Okay.
Yeah, Rick, question for you. With the brain-body processing negative experience much more deeply than it does positive experience, are there any specific practices that can be done to build up a reservoir or a battery charge of positive brain chemistry to counteract the negative experiences that inevitably will come up?
Great question. Quickly here, I'd like to put a big shout-out for taking in the good as a regular practice. Shameless plug, it's one of the chapters in my book, Buddha's Brain. I think it's so important. I devoted a whole chapter to it. Second, really consciously mounting a calming, chilling response, as Terry said, both in the face of threat and more generally, in other words, activating the parasympathetic nervous system. Third, given our profoundly social nature, I mean, there's what's called the social brain hypothesis or theory, really, that the main driver of the evolution of the brain over the last 5 million years, maybe even the last 50 million years, was love, broadly defined. In other words, the reproductive advantages in terms of biological evolution of social skills have really built out the brain. So doing things where we bring to mind the felt sense of connection with others is a very important practice on a regular basis and is a great one to do if you're in a situation that feels challenging or you're about to go into a challenging situation or you're dealing with challenging material that's simply arising inside your own mind, to start with bringing to mind the sense of being with people who care about you. I think the last thing I'll say in passing, I'll say two things actually, next to last, is beware paper tiger paranoia. It's so interesting. I just did a post for Huffington Post. It's actually been splashed big in their living section on Sunday. So if you want to see it, go to the Huffington Post living section or just Google me and Huffington Post. And I got a lot of comments, including comments that were really, you know, worked up that I didn't seem to realize that Stephen Colbert was joking when he talks about having a rally to keep fear alive and so forth. So, you know, that post is a very good summary of my take on paper tiger paranoia, and I think a great way we can help ourselves is to calm down. Like I deliberately, when I go through the airport and I get all those threat level orange messages, is to calm my body down and remind myself, no, the odds of a bad event on my flight on this day are threat level chartreuse. You know, a bucket of green with a drop of yellow paint. That is it. And so when we're faced with yammering voices, whether on the left or the right or the middle, or I don't care, whether it comes from red, blue, or purple, is to not be pushed around by these voices that want to alarm us and often, therefore, cow us. And then the last thing is to take productive action to make this world a better place. I mean, one of the best ways to deal with fear and one of the best ways to deal with feeling pushed around by life is to be a hammer instead of a nail. Whether it's taking action inside your own head, which is a great place to start, it's where you have the most influence, so you're not, for example, frightened and cowed by paper tiger alarms. That's a great place. But to go beyond that, to take action out into the world, whether it's talking to other people or sending a letter to someone or money to someone or working harder to get a stoplight in a busy intersection so the kids can walk across without getting whacked, you know, or risking getting whacked and so forth. You know, taking action is a very powerful way to defeat the bias inside mammals in general and humans in particular toward learned helplessness.
Very good. We have another question here from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Oops, just a second, looking for it. Having a little trouble with my interface. Here you go, Cheyenne, Wyoming. I think you're unmuted. Are you there? Hello? Okay, I'm going to try you again. Nope, I've lost you. We have two questions from Anonymous and Unavailable. Anonymous, you're live. Hello? You're unmuted. You've raised your hand. Hello? Okay, I'm going to go to Unavailable.
Is that me?
Yeah, I guess so. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question about I'm wondering if your work has looked of cell phone radiation and wireless technologies on the brain and body cells, being that they're receptors and transmitters that conduct higher consciousness. So now that the human brain is exposed to these new energies in the last over the last 60 years of various neurotoxins or the cell phone radiation or the wireless technologies, things that the Buddha and Jesus never had to contend with. How do you see that as not going into a paper tiger, but using that discerning awareness between what's a real threat that can diminish our brain's capacity to evolve, to conduct those higher consciousnesses? Or what is your take on that? Have you looked at that at all?
Well, thank you.
What's your name?
Marie.
Marie, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Marie. Honestly, I'm speaking here more as a private citizen, as it were, than a professional. I think of those as probably real tigers. In other words, I think while studies are just starting to come in about the risks for brain cancer from long-term exposure to electromagnetic fields, including those from a cell phone held right next to one's head, and those early studies are raising concerns. For example, I use a cell phone with a headset, and I really don't like putting that little gadget right next to my head. And beyond cell phones, of course, is the whole question of living next to, underneath power poles. For example, my office suite mates and I were looking at a place to rent about 6 years ago, and one of the potential offices was right next to the switching station for the entire office building complex, which was a huge transformer. We could hear it humming all day long. Nope, we weren't going to put our office right next to that one. So I think that it goes to a kind of a larger way of thinking about this stuff in terms of cost-benefit analysis. I spent a year doing risk analyses, probabilistic risk analyses, for a mathematician from Princeton, and dealing with things like what are the odds of a nuclear power plant melting down and exciting stuff like that. And one of the takeaways from that is if the potential consequences are high and of something like, let's say, putting a cell phone receiver right next to your head, and the costs of an alternative are low, like getting a headphone or a speakerphone or not using your cell that much and so forth, then it's prudent to do that. Another example of that clearly for me is that the potential benefits of long-term use of nutritional supplements to make up for the fact that the modern diet is very lacking for most people in key nutrients, and also make up for the fact that all of us these days, even people living in Polynesian atolls, are exposed to toxins of various kinds that our ancestors did not evolve to metabolize and detox and handle and so forth, that it makes sense to me to spend a few extra bucks a month, or a few dozen extra bucks a month, alas, to, take supplements, because, of course, the risks of a negative effect from that intervention are very, very low. I mean, these are molecules the body evolved to process. Obviously, be judicious. But that said, the potential benefits are very, very high. So, yeah, I get upwind if I'm pouring gas in my car. I like my brain. I want to take good care of it over the long haul. And I'm thoughtful about things like electrical fields.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, that's something I've gotten into quite a lot myself. I agree. We have a question on the Instant Teleseminar window from Maria Nathi in Caracas, Venezuela. What does neuroscience have to say? How would it interpret the clearing of some skaras or mental impressions that color our personal world, which yoga practice considers a given in the process of freeing the mind and limited self?
Yeah, deep question. Well, I would say first, a little bit it has to do with how we define the term samskara. Some people, it's implicit, and that may be the case with the person who's asking this question. Some people think of it, samskaras, as passed on from life to life. as kind of residues that are transferred in through reincarnation, and then we work with them in some way in this current life. And then another way of defining the samskaras, which would be more operationally within this life, as afflictive mental contents of one kind or another. And in terms of the latter definition, we're certainly right there squarely within the realm of Western science and neuropsychology. There may well be, I think, a transcendental X factor that's irreducibly involved in consciousness and mental life and so forth. But I would have to say, that said, there's still plenty of things we can do that are already clearly established within the well-trod frame of Western science in terms of how we can actually specifically use our mind to change our brain, to change our mind for the better, and so forth, and directly act on the samskaras there. I also think of the ways in which, as a guy, sidebar, whose personal opinion is that there probably is something to reincarnation. If samskaras do pass from life to life, well, how do they manifest in this life? Well, I think they get woven into things like DNA and neural tissue and neural structure, because this is an embodied life, you know, and the samskaras activate through the body and via the body and in the body and to the body. So for both those ways of defining samskaras, I think that there's plenty you can do, ranging from Michael Murphy's practices or what Terry teaches in terms of integral life practice, or the various methods in my book, you know, that you can use to, you know, use your mind to change your brain and so forth. There are plenty of ways to change these cars. I often think that, you know, we've got plenty to do without getting preoccupied with the esoteric possibilities, which I think are fun to talk about and think about, are very important and so forth. But that said, even apart from whatever the esoteric possibilities are, the exoteric realities and opportunities are more than enough to handle in any human life.
Mm. Wow. Great, Rick. I want to keep charging ahead, but I can see by the clock that we're out of time. We have really had a rich conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, I thank you. This was, like I said earlier, a complete privilege to participate in. And I really wish everyone who heard this, you know, I really wish you the best. And, you know, may all beings truly be happy.
Right on. Well, before I tell everybody here about what's coming up next week and we get a chance to say goodbye, a few reminders. Want to remind you of our Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook and our blog, beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. You're invited to post your comments on the blog about today's dialogue, either on Facebook or the blog, and also your suggestions for questions for Tuesday's dialogue with Catherine Woodward Thomas. And if you know anybody who might be interested in this series, please forward them one of the emails so they can join us too, or invite them to register at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you want to learn more about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And I want to thank some of the partners and sponsors who've made this all possible, especially Boulder Integral. Do you have an important idea or project in your life that needs a jump start? Maybe it's the new business you've dreamed of starting, or an important initiative for your job or company. Perhaps it's a creative project like writing a book, a blog, or a screenplay, or maybe you'd just like to press reset on your career and develop an entirely new vision for yourself. If so, please consider attending the Integral Incubator, a 5-day boot camp in Boulder, Colorado, where you'll work with Ken Wilber, Jeff Salzman, and an expert team of Integral coaches to make your dream a reality. Find out more about the Integral Incubator at integralincubator.com. That's integralincubator.com. Also, Maestro Conference. Maestro Conference is a unique voice-based online collaboration platform that integrates the web and your telephone to support large-scale, real-time remote conferences, seminars, and interactive events. Using cutting-edge technology that empowers individual awareness and engagement, Maestro Conference offers a whole new way to engage people and create relationships, combining the ease of passive media with the engagement and excitement of live events. Visit them on the web at maestroconference.com. That's M-A-E-S-T-R-O, maestroconference.com. And also by our dear friends at Integral Enlightenment.
Integral Enlightenment is an authentic contemporary approach to spiritual practice designed to bring about a total transformation of our humanity. Founded by evolutionary pioneer Craig Hamilton, Integral Enlightenment seeks to revitalize the spiritual path to meet the evolutionary needs of humanity in the 21st century. Integral Enlightenment is a path for those of us who know deep down that spiritual life is about much more than our personal happiness and contentment. It's for those of us who feel compelled to transform ourselves in order to serve the greatest calling there is, the further evolution of life, humanity, and consciousness itself. To find out more about the work of Craig Hamilton and Integral Enlightenment, please visit integralenlightenment.com. I also want to remind you of the websites to investigate Rick's own work, wisebrain.org and Rick Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, rickhanson.net. And remember, please tune in 2 days on Tuesday. I'll be talking with Catherine Woodward Thomas, the co-founder with Claire Zammit of the Feminine Power Global Practice Community, on Evolving Together, Why We Need Each Other to Become Ourselves Fully. Most of us have been working on ourselves, by ourselves, for decades, inching our way toward the lofty and noble goal of realizing our highest potentials. Yet, in spite of our tireless efforts, even those of us blessed with caring and supportive friends and families and loving spiritual communities still often feel as though we don't have the kind of support we'd need to be able to midwife the unmanifest potentials of our lives into the manifest world and powerfully pioneer that which is ours to create. Our whole approach to realizing our potentials has tended to be inside of a masculine power system, the power of the individual. Yet feminine power, the power of relatedness, emancipates us from the slow and steady progress of our individual strivings by tapping into the power of the collective field, which promises to catapult us toward the fullest expression of our unique gifts and talents in ways that we might never have imagined possible before. Please join Catherine Woodward Thomas as she shares from the leading edge of the Feminine Power Global community on how we might begin to evolve together to bring forth the highest possible potentials for human flourishing. And next Sunday, a week from today, but now this will be at an earlier time, 11 a.m. Pacific time, not 5 p.m., because I'll be broadcasting live from Berlin, Germany, in conversation with the dynamic and original German spiritual teacher, Thomas Hubel, who has really lit a fire over there. You may not know about him, but I highly recommend catching that. So please mark your calendars. And finally, it's come time for us to hear each other's voices. So I'd like to open up our phone line so we can all hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Thank you for joining us. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Wonderful.
Adios.
Okay.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Okay. I have to stay on the line here until we finish the recording. I think it's done now. Goodbye.